Welcome to the Funds Fanatic podcast, where we chew the cud on the news affecting investment funds and trusts. I'm Daniel Groats, editor of Funds Insider, and I'm delighted that this week joining us we have Mark Slater, a fund manager who's been investing in the UK stock market for more than a quarter of a century. Mark is Citywire AA rated. He runs the Slater Recovery and Slater Growth Funds. Mark, delighted that you're joining us.
Thank you.
So, Mark, if I could kick off, as I said in the intro, you've been an investor in the UK stock market for over 25 years. You've seen your share of stock market crises. How does the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on the UK stock market, how does that rank in history?
In my experience, it's definitely different to anything else I've seen. I think the main way it's different, I think there are probably two things. One is it's affected everything pretty well. In fact, it's affected most people, at least. Not necessarily all businesses have been impacted in the same way, but it's affected most people. There's no avoiding it. I think the other aspect of it is that, unlike in previous crises or crashes, there's no real distinction between good and bad businesses, in the sense that a business can be very well managed, can be very prudent in terms of its balance sheet, and could just have been unfortunate in being targeted by COVID, if you like. Whereas in most crises, it's normally businesses that have behaved stupidly get hurt worst. There's a certain sort of moral dimension to it that sort of works out as it should. Whereas in this case, it's not the case, you know, that isn't happening. So you do have some businesses that have just done nothing wrong, but happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, which is sad, I think, and, you know, slightly unfair. So those are the differences.
I mean, the UK stock market has been disproportionately badly hit by coronavirus, and that's affected your funds, which you've done better than the broader UK stock market, but it has nonetheless affected the shares of companies that you invest in. And if I look at some of your largest holdings, I mean, a company like IWG stands out as one that, in the teeth of the crisis, as a serviced office provider. How did you react as stock markets descended as they did in February and March? Did you buy anything, sell anything, do nothing?
We were buying quite actively. We did well. The first thing we did was look at survivability. And just to backtrack a little bit, you know, we were conscious that COVID was very serious when it was, you know, particularly focused on China. And we were surprised there wasn't more of a stock market impact over here. This is back in January. But we were looking at our exposure to Chinese demand, to complex supply chains, to all the sorts of things that you would expect to be impacted if China had a particular problem. We didn't really join the dots and assume it was going to come over to the West and that we would have all the lockdowns and what have you that we've seen. So until it was a bit late. So once it was obvious there was an impact here, there was already a price impact, and it was late really to do much that was going to be very helpful on the sell side. We did, though, review survivability. So that was our most immediate concern. You know, did we own businesses that might not get through it? Once we were comfortable that they would get through it, then we were really looking to buy. And we've been very active on the buy side. So we've added quite a lot of new names to the portfolios. So we've added, you know, five or six new names, that sort of thing. But we've added significantly to the number of our existing holdings as well. You know, 14, 15 existing holdings we've added to materially. So we have deployed a lot of capital. We had a lot of cash. We've deployed a lot of cash in that period. The IWGs of this world are in the very sort of, they're in the complicated category for sure. We own a handful of companies. I would say roughly an eighth of our portfolios are in that category of being directly in the gun sights of COVID-19. They're businesses that have done nothing wrong. Our view of IWG is that the trend towards more flexible office space, like most trends in relation to COVID, most trends that were there prior to COVID, they're going to be accelerated. So I think their market will actually get bigger. They'll clearly be a winner. Their competitive position is massively enhanced as a result of all the problems for other companies in that space. But they're going to have a very tough year or so dealing with all the problems and complications, tenants not paying, haggling with landlords, all that kind of thing.
And so, Mark, you mentioned you bought a handful of new stocks. Which companies, what kind of sector, where were you putting money?
Quite a wide variety of companies, really. We bought an initial holding in Countryside, the building business, which has got up a nice amount already. We established a position in Renew. We bought a holding in Dart, which is a business that's clearly very much impacted by COVID. It's a business we've always much admired. And the shares were smashed by COVID. We came in on their sort of, wasn't a rescue financing, but it was, it was certainly at a very cheap level.
If I was going to characterize those new buys, I mean, looking at Countryside and Dart in particular, it seems it's less companies that you see as gaining any sort of advantage from the pandemic, more those that have been weakened, but you just think the stock market reaction is implying that they're weaker than they are.
Well, I think, yes, I mean, any business that's, I mean, Dart is very severely impacted because for a period they weren't able to operate their business, whereas, Countryside was operating at a reduced level. So they're different businesses, but we owned quite a lot of businesses already that really are not affected by COVID. And we've added to some of those, but we already own them. So I would say roughly in our portfolios, I mentioned about an eighth, say 12-13% of our holdings are in areas where there's been shutdown or something very severe that's taken place. Doesn't mean they're suddenly bad businesses. It just means you've got to look at them slightly differently. And then the rest of our portfolios, roughly half and half, I would split between businesses that are either mildly benefiting or barely affected. And then again, another chunk in businesses where there is a clear impact. It's normally not a demand impact. It's normally a sort of disruption impact. It's relatively modest and it's clearly temporary. And both of those categories are very easy to analyze. In the first category, you can just ignore COVID completely and just analyze the numbers in the way that you would have done before, but obviously a bit more warily. And in that second category, where there's a temporary impact, you've got to quantify it. You've got to be comfortable that it is very temporary. But again, the analysis isn't terribly complicated. It's that last category that's complicated. And I have to say, when it all started off, our hope was that we could make a lot of money in that really complicated category. That has been made more difficult by all the government schemes, which of course were necessary. For the country, they were necessary, but it did take away a lot of opportunity for investors. It took away the possibility of making 10 or 20 times your money on a business you got to know really well, where everyone else thought it might fail and you took the view that it wouldn't. Now, failure in the public markets is quite hard. The banks are, they're being a bit tougher now, but they were very, very, very lenient a couple of months back. Equity markets are providing capital as well. So the failure risk really has gone. That would have provided, it would have created a lot of pain, but it would have created a lot of additional opportunity that's been taken away. So, our thinking has had to change as well. When it all started off, we thought we would really try and make money in two areas. One, businesses that just were being derated but weren't terribly impacted. And two, businesses which were really badly affected, where we had some sort of better understanding or information advantage. And that second category has been more difficult, because they haven't fallen as much as they otherwise would have done, and therefore the upside is less than it could have been.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned that you've taken part in a lot of the fundraisings launched by the company that you already held.
Yeah.
Presumably, you would have, without the sort of stimulus that we've seen from government, you would have expected to have seen more of those fundraisings and at a much more distressed level than we have seen.
Exactly. And we would have been in the pound seats. Whereas what's taken place it's actually quite surprising, you know, all of a sudden the markets are awash with money, but because I think investors feel supported at least to a degree by policy, and companies can do placings in a couple of afternoons at a 3% discount, and they can do 20% placings, you know, big ones. You know, Informa, which is not a company we own, but they raised $1 billion in a few days. You know, that would normally be a really big deal. That would be a headline grabbing thing. And they did it. It was just people queued up to buy them, and it was massively oversubscribed. And, you know, and there have been lots of those. So it's been very easy for companies have really held the whip hand in this process. They know there's appetite. And I think if there'd been more uncertainty, it would have been deeply unpleasant for everybody. But if there'd been more uncertainty, investors would have held the whip hand, and there would have been some very profitable, really very distressed situations. So that extreme distress was taken away really by policy.
And what that does to your opportunities as an investor, because I think it's probably fair to say that you've made your name as a growth investor, but recovery and special situation opportunities are, you know, they're certainly a component of the Slater Recovery Fund. I guess you're just not seeing the same amount of special situations or recovery situations.
Well, I mean, the best recovery situation, I think, is a great growth business that's just deeply misunderstood. And, you know, we had in the last crisis, we bought a company called Cape, and we made 35 times our money in a few years. It was very quick because the whole market assumed it was going bust. And our view was that it actually couldn't go bust. Its working capital profile was such that if it did less business, the cash poured in. So we knew it couldn't go bust, you know, and we knew that it was broadly speaking in good growth areas. So that was a fantastically profitable insight. But it was basically a growth business. You know, once the dust settled, it began to be perceived as a growth business. But that brief moment in, you know, the worst point in 2008, 2009, people, well, the word growth didn't appear and it just wasn't in people's minds, but they've just focused purely on debt. And almost any amount of debt was too much debt. So that's an ideal scenario when people really panic about the best businesses. That happened for a couple of days at the end of March. Literally, it was the 23rd of March, was that you saw on an intraday basis, a number of companies. So a good example is our largest holding, Future Group. They fell, they were £15 a share roughly at the end of last year. They fell at one point at the end of March to £5 a share, for only momentarily, and you know for minutes. But they're now, they had a very good trading statement today. They're now £13.80, so they're not far off where they started. And that business is barely, that business in profit terms is not affected by COVID. In turnover terms, it's slightly affected. So you know, there were the window for that extremely attractive, sort of very distressed type investing was incredibly brief.
I guess the frustration in your position is that those sorts of opportunities, presumably you're fairly limited in the extent to which you're able to take them up, because that would necessitate selling another stock which has been equally unfairly impacted, unless you're getting inflows into your fund, which most funds weren't in the teeth of the crisis.
Well, funny enough, we had inflows in the teeth of the crisis, which surprised me. Again, that's the first time in my experience that's happened. In every other period where there's been extreme dislocation, we have seen outflows, not necessarily enormous ones, but certainly the inflows have stopped. That wasn't the case in March. The inflows continued. It was very odd. I'm delighted they did, but it is strange. And we had plenty of liquidity, so we were in a position to go shopping, and we're still in that sort of shopping mindset. There are still good, you know, very interesting things around. So I'm happy with the opportunity set, but my point is just that if that extreme distress had played out for even another week, it would have been, you know, we'd have made a lot of money. But it didn't happen. And I think, you know, taking a sort of step back from it all, it's probably a good thing it didn't happen. So.
And those opportunities that you talk about, where you mentioned CAPE, a company where you understood something about the business that you just thought the stock market didn't, and you were proved right in the end. Are those sorts of opportunities, are they more prevalent the lower you go down the market cap scale? Because if looking at your funds, they seem relatively agnostic about how big a company is. You'll have FTSE 100 companies, you'll have alternative investment market companies in there. But do you see the best opportunities in the smaller companies?
I think you're always going to get the greatest scope for mispricing in smaller businesses, unless there's a lot of dislocation. With dislocation, I think you can get mispricing anywhere. But things become more efficient more quickly as you go up the market cap scale. So yeah, I think that's right.
I'm just wondering if you see any more constraints on you culturally as a fund manager. I'm thinking about the way that you run your funds, which is in a relatively concentrated way, and the positions that you have in smaller companies, and fund managers running big positions in smaller companies. That's been under focus after the high profile issues for Neil Woodford. More recently, we've had Alex Darwall, who runs the European Opportunities Trust, being hit hard by the collapse of a very big position in Wirecard. Do you feel that there is more resistance to taking concentrated, punchy positions now?
I would say that in recent years, there's more appetite amongst investors for more concentration and more conviction, I would say. There's been a backlash against all the closet tracking that's taken place in the industry, which I think is a scandal. There was a lot of that going on, and people were charging basically for trackers, but they were charging very high fees. So I think there is an appetite for concentration, but of course, the more concentrated you are, you've got to be right, for sure. The Woodford debacle, I think, highlighted a lot of things that really were self-evident. I mean, it was obvious to us what was happening there 3 years before it blew up. It was obvious there was massive style drift. That is really nothing to do with big or small companies, but he was a guy who was good at big companies. He was no good at small companies, and he was very bad at, unquoted companies. And he just shifted from an area he was comfortable to an area he wasn't comfortable. That, I think, is a problem when people move away from their last, their comfort zone. That's always a problem. I think, similarly, if someone does have redemptions, they've got to sell the difficult stuff at the same time as the easy stuff. Otherwise, the more illiquid things become bigger and bigger. That's always been our policy. A really big thing as well is not just the liquidity of what you own. It's also you've got to look at who owns you. And, Woodford had very high levels of concentration of investors in his fund, and relatively small numbers of them did cause him very big problems. We have a very, very nicely diverse ownership of our funds, which is crucial to us. So there's a whole lot of other things too. We have very strong risk controls. We have people in the business who can say no to me. A lot of it's pretty simple stuff. But to your point, yes, if you've got a very big position, it's much more important you're right. And so we do a lot of our emphasis, our work is on issues around that. We want to be right on we want to be right on everything we own, but we particularly want to be right on the big ones.
And for those listeners who may not know as much about your funds, I mean, you're running, what's it, around sort of 30 stocks in each, more or less than that?
No, it's typically sort of 45 to 50. That will be the even 40 to 50 is the norm.
And so that's the more kind of concentrated, fewer stocks type approach that listeners might know from the likes of Terry Smith or Nick Train, who are also known as not buying and selling shares very often. You're more active than that.
Well, no, we've owned a lot of our bigger holdings. We've owned for 10 years, so quite a long time. We're long term, but occasionally, like last year, we had seven bids in the portfolio. That's much more than usual. We don't seek them out. They came to us, and our average over the years is probably one or two. So that was a function last year of the UK really being on sale as far as international investors are concerned. And I think if not for COVID, that would have continued this year. So we get the odd bid, we things of that like that happen, but our top 10 doesn't change much over the years. But if we find a smaller business, then that it might be a 1% unit. If it's a very small company, we're not going to size it beyond 1% or thereabouts, because it wouldn't make sense from a liquidity perspective. So liquidity is something we take very seriously, but we're long term in our thinking. We're not in and out of companies at all.
And you mentioned the UK sort of being on sale last year, and I just wonder what your view is on the prospects for the UK stock market now, because obviously it's been under the cloud of Brexit uncertainty for a good number of years, and there was that lifting, it seemed, at the end of last year with the emphatic election result. And then we've had coronavirus, and that's been a pandemic that has affected the UK stock market disproportionately more than other markets. So I just wonder where you see the market and its value at the moment.
I think since the referendum in 2016, there was a lot of concern over Brexit. I think in 18 and 19, the concern really became more about Corbyn, and that risk was eliminated at the end of last year. And I also think the Brexit risk is obviously still there. It's not something one can dismiss out of hand. But I think people are more relaxed about it because there's more of a sense of purpose with the majority government. So I think the two things that really worried people, one's gone and one is diminished. And that's why I think, and all these bids I mentioned, by the way, most of those took place before the election result. So this was, overseas investors taking a view. They were buying strategically, but they were in their minds buying very cheaply. And they had the benefit of the currency as well. That will continue, in my view, because the UK is cheap on an international basis. I think the UK, it clearly has lagged other markets. Europe isn't far ahead of us. Europe and the UK are not towards the bottom of the pile. That, I think, is mostly a function of tech, or the lack of tech in the indices. And you can see that in America. The NASDAQ is the best performing American index by far. And the other indices all do have a lot of tech in them. So that, I think, would explain the behaviour of the UK market.
And obviously the UK market and the UK economy are two different things. I'm just wondering sort of what proportion of your fund is exposed to the UK domestic economy, and how your view on the UK economy colours that.
We're roughly, and it's very difficult to be precise on these things, but we're roughly 50% exposed in profit terms to the UK. That's right to the nearest probably 5% or so. So, but we're very happy to own a business that's entirely in the UK. So we haven't sort of sought that. We haven't targeted a percentage. If we find a really good niche business in the UK that's growing nicely and there are really clear drivers of growth, we're very happy to own it. We invest in the UK because we know the UK market well. And it's easy for us to check things out because we live here. So, and we've got strong networks here and all of those things. Whereas, we find a business in another market, it's a whole lot of work, and it's more complicated. So, the UK is a big, one of the biggest economies in the world still. There's some great businesses here, but there are a whole lot of businesses that I would never consider owning. Our initial screens in our process eliminate 95% of the market almost immediately. So we're only really looking at 5% of the market. And then of that, we buy a proportion. So it's most companies are just not of interest to us because they're not growing, or they're not generating cash, or they're too expensive, or maybe some other reason. So, if one's careful and one's you have high standards about what you buy, then you can end up with very interesting businesses here.
And right at the beginning of this, we talked about some of the companies that you own that had been most adversely affected by coronavirus. I guess as we're kind of rounding off the interview, we'll do so on a more positive note. Some of the companies that you have that have been relative winners, I mean, I'm looking at your fact sheets and I'm seeing Codemasters in there, which the computer game stock, which has done well. Which companies would you highlight?
Well, Codemasters has I mean, gaming generally has been seen as a beneficiary of lockdown because people are stuck at home twiddling their thumbs. So that, you know, in our industry, we haven't been, but in other industries, people have been stuck at home with not much to do. And Codemasters, in my view, is the cheapest quoted gaming company here. It's very well managed. It's got a very clear specialization in driving games. They've now got a good range of different franchises as well. So I'm very keen on the business. The shares, you know, were knocked at one point during the year, but they've been recovering nicely and they're well into new high territory. But I still think they've got plenty of mileage. Future, which is our largest holding, which I touched on, you know, they had a trading statement this morning, and the shares are up 14% today. They've confirmed that they think they'll be at the upper end of the forecast range for the year to the end of September. And again, that's a business I would have thought there would have been more of an impact, actually, from COVID. But their model is, you know, they buy content and they monetize it online. Some of the content they buy is magazine content. And obviously, magazine sales have been killed because shops that sell magazines have been closed. But what we've been pleased to see is, yes, there's been some impact in the magazine space, but it's been more than offset by the best part of the business, which is the e-commerce related part of the business. That's the bit we're actually interested in, and that's been doing really well. It's very high margin business as well. So we've been pleasantly surprised by Future. And, you know, like anything, I don't think COVID was purely good or purely bad for any business. Certainly for those that aren't particularly badly affected, there'll be some problems. Even Amazon, you know, they've been seen as a massive beneficiary, but they've had to take a lot of people on. They've had to, you know, incur a lot of costs. But the best businesses have been able to take it in their stride, and they'll come out of it very strongly. And that's the key focus. I think you've got to look ahead at the landscape in 6, 12, 18 months, whatever it is, and ask yourself, you know, will this business, you know, be trading well, but also will its competitive position have been enhanced? And that's a crucial question. And most of the companies we own, we get strong yeses on those questions.
Well, Mark, that's a great point on which to end. And thanks again for joining us. And hopefully we'll have you back on the show in the not too distant future.
Great pleasure. Thank you.